This episode is brought to you in part by the Table Podcast from the Hendricks Center at Dallas Theological Seminary. I'm Daryl Bach, one of the hosts, and I invite you to join us as we discuss issues of God and culture, which includes anything and everything. Listen on your podcast app or at dts.edu/thetable.
This episode is brought to you in part by Thomas Nelson, publisher of Every Day a Miracle, Trusting the God Who Heals Us Inside and Out. Written and narrated by Matthew Stephen Brown, and is available everywhere audiobooks are sold.
Hello, this is Russell Moore, and you're listening to Signposts. Today, I'm going to have a conversation with one of my all-time favorite authors, Marilyn Robinson, who's going to join us in a few moments. But I wanted to say a few things about her before she joins us, because there may be some of you who, like I am, you read everything that Marilyn Robinson writes. Some of you may have, like I do in front of me right now, a stack of Marilyn Robinson books that are marked through and have book flags and highlights all through it. But there may be some of the others of you who aren't familiar with Marilyn Robinson. And what I'd like to say to you about her is that she's a very unlikely figure in many ways. I mean, this is someone who's a Pulitzer Prize winning author. She was interviewed by the President of the United States, Barack Obama, in the New York Review of Books a couple of years ago. And she didn't interview him. He interviewed her, which I don't know that I've ever seen that happen before. But she's able to speak, it seems to me, to all kinds of people, whether they're very, very secular or whether they're very religious. And I think there are some reasons for that, because she tends to have sharp intuitions about what it means to be human and what it means to consider how it is to live a human life. She's a mainline Protestant, United Church of Christ. She and I would probably disagree on many, many different theological issues, but she's someone that has benefited my life in many ways by these little vignettes that stay with me. I remember at one point I was going through a time of suffering, and I just happened to find a line by Marilyn Robinson when she's talking about when you're going through a time of suffering, remembering that everyone has gone through suffering and that beautiful things can come out of this. It's something I knew, but the way that she said it at the moment struck me. Another thing was, she wrote this in her novel Gilead several years ago, and it's something that has stayed with me forever. This is a minister, Iowa pastor, who is hurtling really toward death at the time, talking, and he says this: "This is an important thing which I have told many people, and which my father told me, and which his father told him. When you encounter another person, when you have dealings with anyone at all, it is as if a question is being put to you. So you must think, what is the Lord asking of me in this moment, in this situation? If you confront insult or antagonism, your first impulse will be to respond in kind. But if you think, as it were, this is an emissary sent from the Lord, and some benefit is intended for me, first of all, the occasion to demonstrate my faithfulness, the chance to show that I do in some small degree participate in the grace that saved me, you are free to act otherwise than as circumstances would seem to dictate. You are free to act by your own lights. You are freed at the same time of the impulse to hate or resent that person. He would probably laugh at the thought that the Lord sent him to you for your benefit and his, but that is the perfection of the disguise, his own ignorance of it." That passage has lodged into my psyche in some really inconvenient ways when I'm having conversations that I don't think I have time for at the moment, or when I'm having encounters that seem very uncomfortable or distressing or even enraging, to say, what does the Lord require of me in this moment with this person that he has sent to me? That's the sort of thing that she examines and unearths and speaks to us about. So let's talk to Marilyn Robinson. Well, I'm happy to be joined here with Marilyn Robinson, one of my all-time favorite authors. I read everything that she writes, whether it's a novel, whether it's a collection of essays, whether it's an article in various publications. And so I cannot believe that I'm actually talking to her today. So you'll have to sort of bear with me as I go fanboy here a little bit today. Thank you for being with me today, Marilyn.
Well, it's a pleasure.
I had given your book to a friend, Gilead, and had recommended it very strongly. And I was surprised that when she read it, she came back and said that she was waiting all the way through for the reveal. And what she was expecting was that John Ames, the minister in the book, would be revealed at some point as sinister. And so she almost had to start back over after she realized that wasn't going to happen, to reread it without all the suspicion. And it seemed to me that there was something kind of parabolic in that, because I think in the background are all the scandals and frauds that we sometimes see associated with clergy, but also just a basic cynicism. And it seemed to me that much of what you write about implicitly in your fiction and often explicitly in your essays is a deconstruction of that sort of cynicism, of the idea that everybody really is just motivated by self-interest. Would that be fair?
That's very fair. Yes, indeed. I think that's such a toxic idea. And it makes people mean-spirited. I just can't imagine why it is so durable in the culture, so much repeated, so much, you know. I mean, we have been taught for a long time to be cynical, suspicious about virtually everything, and, you know, forgetting that makes people cynical toward us, you know. I mean, it's applied so universally that it's as if people are shy to attempt to speak authentically because it's as if they're setting themselves up to be revealed, you know.
Well, I'd like to explore a little bit, on the one hand, this going on in sort of the secularized modern world with the idea of selfish gene and those sorts of ideas, as well as the kind of Freudian, I have to explore all of my motives all the time, and there's something dark and hidden behind everything, which you argue in, I think it's in What Are We Doing Here? Collection of essays, that you really can't build a society off of that. But also within the church, I think there's a great deal of suspicion of one another and of ourselves, even within the church.
I think so, too. It's amazing that one has the feeling of alienation between the society at large and the church, but in fact, they really mirror each other very strongly. You know, I think that many of the same traits occur in contemporary religious thinking or occur in the evasions that many contemporary religious people attempt in order to, I mean, they're basically, they are conceding the truth of the ideas that they fear, and they go into evasion strategies in order to protect themselves, in effect, from these ideas, which if they simply looked at them directly would seem trivial and wrong and bizarre. In many cases, for example, you know, the Freudian self.
You mention in one of your essays, you talk about writing explicitly Christian themes, and that someone asked you, aren't you scared to do that, to write about Calvinism and about all of these various things? And you were really struck by that. And it seems to me as I read that is something I think many Christian people face in whatever arena they're living in, is this sense of fear if I talk about these things that matter to me. So you really haven't faced that sense of being thought of as strange or odd or subversive by being a Christian in the outside world?
Not at all. I mean, I have, you know, my books come out in China, Japan, and everywhere. People are, you know, they're interested in seeing a major tradition of religious thought dealt with seriously and in art, you know, which is simply what people did for thousand years before whatever strange silence it is descended on Christian intellectualism, as you mentioned.
Hmm. Well, you...
I mean, I find it perfectly welcome. I don't think I could have happened upon, a sort of centering preoccupation that would have found so much receptivity all over the world. I mean, it's not, in Italy, my books are read, and, I encounter no rejection on the basis of it.
Hmm. Well, and it's not just Christianity that you talk about. You're out to recover some really scary figures to most modern people, John Calvin and the Puritans.
Yes.
What led you to say, I want to explicitly talk about these figures?
There are these little accidents of being assigned, part of an essay by Jonathan Edwards and finding out that there are beautiful ideas in it, that sort of thing that makes it the sort of stereotype of Edwards so trivial and so wrong, And I became very aware in the course of my education of how many important people are treated so dismissively that the book is closed on them. Nobody actually knows what Calvin thought. Nobody actually knows what Edwards wrote. And the list is very long of these people who acquire this strange cultural significance as being epitomes of what is boring and unlikable and retrograde and so on. It has a huge impact on the culture because so much of American civilization especially disappears behind this eclipse, And you find it everywhere. I mean, it permeates the culture in a way that you sometimes don't think anything does, Everybody knows what to say about John Calvin, but nobody has read him,
Well, and you mentioned also that Jonathan Edwards, most people think of someone who preached sermons about spiders. And yet you talk about, at one point, I can't even remember where right now, about reading that footnote of Edwards. And I was expecting it to be, I could think of any number of essays that I was expecting it to be, but it was on moonlight.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yes. The doctrine of original sin descended. Mm. There it is, moonlight. He's a beautiful writer, and he is, I think every philosopher will say, although perhaps they can't cite chapter and verse, he is the greatest American philosopher.
Hmm.
And how in the world, if that is true, even if you find spiders on every third page, how can you possibly neglect him in the way that he is, or how deride him in the way that people do?
Hmm. Well, and it seems to me that the idea that you observed there of God continuously creating and God continuously present in creation really plays into this theme that you talk about so often of grace. And I was just struck reading the trilogy, how many times you go back to that question of facing the future on the basis of grace. So there's Glory says at one point about her father, I believe, grace seems to answer every question as far as he's concerned.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Well, that footnote we were talking about, that was really a seminal moment in my mental life. Mm-hmm. I've really been sort of living off that ever since, how you can understand the stability of being and the freedom of God simultaneously, I hate determinism in every form feels very false to me, but I'd never found my way around it as a way of thinking. And of course I was being taught, models of psychology and so on that are highly determinist. Almost every version of modern thought is determinist. And then when I read that, I thought, yes, being is stable and God is free. These things are simultaneous.
Hmm. It seems that the grace that you are talking about so often, that's a theme so often, especially in your fiction, is something that doesn't... I was trying to think about Lila, for instance, in terms of a typical... If this were an evangelical fictional piece meant to win people to Christ. Lila probably would have been someone who had this very dramatic turnaround, and everything would have been darkness until she came into the church, and then everything light after that. But the grace in the life of Lila is so much more complicated and so much more real, in my view. She's someone who has genuine traumas and horrible things in the background, but she doesn't turn into a caricatured saint after that either.
Right, exactly. She takes from, I believe that God gives us interesting lives and that we make from them what we, you know, I mean, given the will, given the grace, we make from them what we can, you know, but not, no life, you know, with them in those terms, no life is simply to be dismissed or disparaged. Who knows what will come of it finally? I mean, you know, that's my Calvinism, I know, but people are on their way somewhere.
That's a very rare perception these days when we're accustomed to hearing people yelling at one another on cable television and on the radio and so forth. It, one of the things that strikes me, and I quote this so often, is just a little section in one of your essays where you talked about the way that a narrative of decline can be stimulating, like a horror movie or a panic attack, you say. And that rings very true to me. I was talking to someone years ago about a church split, a congregation that had become very angry with one another and just all sorts of drama. And I said, what's at the root of that? And the person who was telling me about it said, well, they're bored. They said, this is kind of the shadow side of the revival meetings where, you know, people needed something to do. So they would go to a revival meeting. And in this case, people needed something to do. So they engineer conspiracy theories about one another and fight with one another. Do you see a way, especially when that does seem to be the entire culture now, of a kind of bungee jumping of controversy for the sake of elevating ones. How do we get around that?
Oh, well, one thing that I really think is missing from religious culture and from secular culture, although I don't really, I'm not comfortable with the idea of secular culture. We don't know what people think. A lot of people are much more religious than anybody simply observing from outside would know, which I think is, you know, again, an important qualifier to a lot of disparaging things that are said or thought. But, you know, Bonhoeffer has that phrase, costly grace. And I really, or cheap grace. And I truly feel that the act of grace from the human side is difficult. It's an expenditure. It's a demand that one places on oneself. It's always easier to do the not gracious thing or think the not gracious thought, you know? I mean, I think that if a sort of ethos of costly grace were instilled in us, we would find it alarming rather than satisfying to make up dreadful stories about one another and so on, you know? I don't believe in conversion experiences like bolts of lightning, but I think that as you go through life, you learn, if you're fortunate, that you have the capacity for grace and that it's it enlarges itself and enlarges your life, actually, you know. I mean, if you actually do something gracious and you know it is, even if you're completely silent and invisible from the point of view of what's happening, that's a joyful thing. You know, and I think the joy of the capacities of the self, intellectual and artistic, but also in terms of the capacity for acting graciously, we have forgotten. I mean, people do not enjoy their lives in a very essential way. They do not, because they can't find themselves to a place where they feel as though they have, you know, a wealth that allows them generosity. And if that only means, you know, the ordinary kindnesses that one has the opportunity to engage in.
You know, the setting that your trilogy in which it takes place, Gilead, if one thinks about those communities right now, we tend to think of those small, more rural communities as being conservators of that kind of kindness. People know their neighbors. We've idealized that in popular culture with Mayberry and other things. And yet right now, one looks around and sees the opioid crisis and skyrocketing unemployment and a foster care crisis and these sorts of things happening in those communities that really do feel as though they're existentially kind of coming apart. Do you see that? Is that the case where we're sort of seeing a hollowing out of rural America?
Yes, I think it's been going on for a long time, and seems to be accelerating and likely to accelerate even faster with these new, we're not going to sell soybeans to China. That's a terrible thought for Iowa and many other states. But in any case, the nature of development of agriculture has simply made it so that a very small workforce is actually needed now relative to the past, when most people were employed in agriculture. And people are very loyal to the place and the culture that they have. Other people, there's something that exasperates me because I grew up in a very small town myself, but people passing through think, oh, there's nothing there. Why don't these people leave, And they don't, I can certainly speak to these very intense emotional bonds that can keep you in a place where it's not easy to live. To abandon it is to kill off a way of life, basically. And a lot of people don't want to do that. But then they get themselves, they get problems like, injuries that make them take opioids and so on. The usual avenue. And, it's they have every difficulty keeping the economy together, and then they have these other problems that always come with people being under too much stress and having too little to look forward to or to form their lives around.
Well, I appreciate the way that you emphasize communal bonds, and that's certainly something we're seeing is a disconnecting of people from one another that leads to that kind of despair. But you also spend a lot of time implicitly in your fiction and explicitly sometimes in your essays talking about the good that comes with a kind of individualism, a kind of integrity. And I was struck by at one point you were talking about Idaho and the West. The word lonesome being something with a positive connotation as opposed to Alabama and Hank Williams, I'm so lonesome I could cry. Do you think that there's a way that we can balance community and the individual in a way that we're just failing at right now?
Well, I of course lean very much toward the individualist side of things. It seems to me in the 19th and the early 20th century in America, it meant people who were self-sufficient in the sense that they made their own judgments about things and they carried their own weight and so on. It did not mean that they were selfish. It didn't mean that they were out for number one. That's a kind of meaning that has come into the language, and we've lost the ability to say, that Abraham Lincoln was a great individual in the sense that he could weather things, he could see beyond immediate miseries and so on, Strength is what individualism used to be associated with, And it's become very much associated now with selfishness of a kind. That is the historic meaning in languages like French, but not in American language. I think that, I talk all the time, of course, about what human beings are just physically and in terms of their nervous systems and all the rest of it. I get that from Calvin, too, and from a lot of the earlier writers. We are so fantastically made, so strangely and wonderfully made. We're for our own use and we're for our own pleasure. We should learn that we have gifts. We should learn that we have strengths. We should learn that we really are unique. Our purpose is not to, camouflage ourselves so that we fit into some imagined general other. That if we think about our lives, we will enjoy them. Yeah. That's what all these lovely old Puritans and so on that I love to read the beauty of language and the beauty of thought, all that is so available to them, so enjoyed by them. I think they're the most joyful strand of Christianity that has existed. And
the Puritans,
so of course, they're, yeah. Hmm. So, of course, they're thought of in precisely the other way.
Well, it's also true that the Old Testament is often thought of as a joyless and kind of mean text, by a lot of Christians. But you go back to the Old Testament constantly. And as a matter of fact, one of my favorite scenes in the Gilead trilogy is when Lila starts reading the Bible, and she starts reading Ezekiel, and you can see Reverend Ames' conflict. Well, it's kind of a bleak book, but she finds a great deal of hope and solace there, and I'm with her. I think that the theme of exile in Ezekiel really does make sense of things. But you've indicated that we've, even within the church, kind of lost a great deal when it comes to the Old Testament and knowing the Old Testament.
It's very true. I'm giving a series of lectures now at Cambridge in England. I've given four, and I have four to give still in the fall. It's called the Halcyon Lecture. And I'm doing quite a radical reconsideration of how the Old Testament is to be read. That the scholarly thing, you know, the higher criticism or documentary hypothesis or however it is described, I think is a complete mistake, and has its foundations in an essay by Wellhausen that is anti-Semitic. There's no question that it is. He ends up by saying, how are we going to get rid of Judaism, you know? And the fact that something as influential as that critical theory has been could be based on thinking with that kind of, you know, foundation, and it's just astonishing to me. Part of the answer always is that it's a very famous essay by a very famous man, therefore no one reads it.
When you think about, well, we have all sorts of people that listen to this program. Many of them aren't religious at all, even. But many of them, probably most of them, are evangelical Christians, and many of them would teach maybe Sunday school or preach in churches. What counsel would you give to people who teach and preach the Bible when it comes to speaking to the world as it is now?
I don't know what the world is now. I really don't. It has so many layers of, conversations and representations and so on of all these different kinds. I've been watching a lot of news lately, like everybody else in the country, you know, and I follow it closely. It's like some endless chess game or something, you know. And then I think afterward, of course, this has wherever you're watching, it's a made object. You know, somebody's making sure the lighting is right. Somebody's making sure that, you know, that certain kinds of things are ready at certain points and all this kind of thing. And you think, this is, however responsibly they do this, it's an artificial consciousness that distracts me from what consciousness actually feels like, you know? And it necessarily, it distracts people from, I think, the workings of their own mind. So much does now. And I think that, I don't know, I feel sorry for the world at large. I can't condemn it at the moment, because I think it tends to be lost in the same sort of maze that I am, you know. I mean, things happen that seem to me to be catastrophically wrong. And I know that there are, I don't know, people who can reconcile themselves to them. You know, it's my great hope is, of course, that God is free relative to the creation. And that the present will not, and you know, go on endlessly or go be part of a vortex of decline that we will not be able to escape.
Would you agree with Frederick Buechner several years ago said that writing fiction taught him how to recognize a plot, and that then he started to realize that there was a plot line to his own life? That rings true to me, of having this intuition that somehow in some way things really are working together towards something. Have you noticed that developing in your own life as you've written over the years?
I don't know if plot is the word I would use because it's a way in which my life there's a great consistency in it, but it seems sort of discontinuous, you know. I mean, I have done very improbable things. I have written a book on plutonium. Boy, is that a hard sell. I have written on Puritanism. I have written, you know, a book about a pastor dying in Iowa in 1956. I have done everything that ought to have a guaranteed failure up to this point. it is, you know, it's a lovely joke, but it does seem kind of like a joke, you know. I've immersed myself in subjects that, in theory, nobody else is interested in. And it turns out that people can be very interested in them, you know. So I did not set out to be a writer. I wrote my first book assuming it would not be published. I wrote my second book kind of half assuming it wouldn't be published. I mean, I'm very grateful for it all. Mm. And I don't feel as if I myself am necessarily the source of these things. They don't reflect decisions in the sense that decisions are what people generally construct their lives out of, you know? Mm.
Puritans talk a lot about spiritual disciplines and about spiritual formation. Are there practices in your life that you would say are the way that you seek to shore yourself up spiritually?
You know, I'm grateful to be able to say that I don't really feel as though my spiritual state is particularly fragile, you know? Mm-hmm. I'm not afraid of not being within, you know, within the being of God, in a sense, you know? Mm. I think a lot of people, they act like they're carrying some little glass of nitroglycerin through life, you know? And they, you know, if they spill it, everything will explode, you know?
Mm-hmm.
But I don't think that's how God relates to us, actually. And I think that the fear that comes with that is something that's very disabling from the point of view of many Christian people.
Hmm. What's your idea of Jesus? When you think of Jesus, what comes to mind first for you?
Well, you know, when I have written what I, you know, call a Christology. I mean, one of those essays, you know, where I actually tried to make myself sit down and think through that. I have in my living room Orthodox images of Christ, mm-hmm. in, you know, the Pantocrator or Pantocrator, however mm-hmm. you said. I think that a problem in Western Christianity is truly that we forget that the crucifixion was the beginning of something other, qualitatively other, you know? Mm. So much of popular religion is taken up with the idea that Jesus died for our sins, you know? Jesus died to transform reality. And I think it's a...
Which would include dying for our sins, would you say?
Pardon?
Which would include dying for our sins as well?
Exactly.
Yeah.
I mean, the being beyond sin is a part of this sort of glorious consequence of the passage through the crucifixion. I think that we forget that Jesus is God. That is the central tenet of our belief.
Mm.
And that the reconception of God around this pervasive, utter act of grace, that's what it's about, you know?
Hmm.
I think that the appropriation of the idea of Jesus suffering to as a balm for our own sense of sinfulness, I think that tends to fix people at a very early stage in their conception of what Christianity ought to be.
Hmm. If you had to choose one hymn and one book of the Bible to be with you the rest of your life, what would you choose?
Oh, let me think. I like the old hymns, you know, the old Charles Wesley hymns. Mm-hmm. But they're all eluding me now. Immortal, invisible, God only wise. Mm. Isn't that a great hymn?
That's great.
And I also, Book of the Bible, that's harder. It depends on, you know, which one I've been looking at.
Mm.
I like Ezekiel. You know, I taught Bible to my students at the workshop. And for writers to read that amazing beginning where something is described without being described, and you know, the apophatic amazing vision,
mm-hmm.
they loved that, and that made me realize what it is, how beautiful it is as a piece of writing.
Mm.
How amazing.
Absolutely. I'm with you on that one. Well, thank you, Marilyn Robinson, for sharing your gifts with the world. I'm very grateful to you for the way that you've helped me to see life, and so thank you for having this conversation with me today.
Oh, thank you.
Well, that was a fascinating conversation, Marilyn Robinson. I'm sitting here again looking at many of her books in front of me, and the way that I read is I put book flags, Office Depot book flags, at places in the text that I want to be able to recover quickly and find where I've highlighted and marked. And I look at these books, and there are book flags everywhere. And I can open them back up and see things that I've forgotten about, but spoke to me very meaningfully at one point and still do. And so it was a joy to talk to her today. I found it interesting that she said that we sometimes want to focus on Christ dying for our sins rather than Christ changing all of reality. I am not sure I agree with her on that. As a matter of fact, I'm quite sure that I don't agree with her on that. It seems to me what she means is that it's easy for us to become self-focused and to think only in terms of my sins through the grace of Christ. But I don't think we give too much focus to that. As a matter of fact, I don't think we give enough focus to that. And I think that's one of the reasons why so many people are bearing the kind of agony and despair that she talks about. As a matter of fact, what it caused me to think about was another line in Gilead when Reverend Ames is talking, and he says this: "That's the strangest thing about this life, about being in the ministry. People change the subject when they see you coming. And then sometimes those very same people come into your study and they tell you the most remarkable things. There's a lot under the surface of life. Everyone knows that. A lot of malice and dread and guilt and so much loneliness where you wouldn't really expect to find it either." I think that's true. And I think that Marilyn Robinson has done remarkable work in showing us something of that, what John Calvin would call depravity, but also beyond that, grace of a God who is immortal, invisible, God only wise. That's true. This is Russell Moore, Marilyn Robinson fan. Glad to talk to her today. And you've been listening to Signposts.